This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio, 855 a.m. on the dial. Also streaming live at 3cr.org.au and on the Community Radio Plus app. You were just listening to Think Again, brought to you by the Borderlands Collective here at 3CR. It's always a pleasure to hear their wonderful voices as we come in. And of course, you can listen to previous shows of theirs at 3cr.org.au/thinkagain. Or listen to them live on Fridays from 10 till 10:30 a.m. I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, you'll be hearing various things from across the world of the radical left. We're going to start off by hearing a conversation that my co-host Hannah did with the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, Joe Samuel King. They're talking about the difficulty in protecting dingoes, their lack of protections, common misconceptions, and how beneficial they are to ecosystems. It's going to be a really beautiful interview. Around 7:40, so that'll take us to around 7:45 after our news headlines. Following that, we'll be hearing an interview from Saturday's episode of Asia Pacific Currents, in which host Giselle Hanna speaks with the president of Doro Chiba, which is a union representing railway workers in the privatized Chiba train line in Japan. They're speaking about the union struggle, which has now spanned 4 decades, against privatization. And yeah, it's also a really beautiful conversation about maintaining worker solidarity over decades of state repression, which I think is super, super timely given the Labour Party is sort of ramping up against staunch militant unions such as the CFMEU and the latest RAFRU. The show is going to end with a conversation with Thomas Locke, who is a rank-and-file member of the Australian Education Union, and will be speaking about the new deal that the union has accepted. Of course, listeners may know that 2 previous deals have been offered by the Victorian government over the past year, both of which had been rejected. And of course, there's been multiple strikes alongside that. So I'm really keen to hear about this new deal and the work of the rank and file to get to this deal, which will make teachers across so-called Victoria the highest paid in the continent. So that's what's happening in the show. I hope everyone has had wonderful weekends. As you may or may not be able to tell, I have been a little bit sick, so I've been mostly just resting, but I had a really beautiful weekend, mostly just spending with community. I attended T Generation's Community Day on Saturday morning, which is really wonderful to see a bunch of like really strong trans people lifting an enormous amount of weight, like physically, which is really beautiful. And on Sunday, I went to a punk gig at Footscray Bolo, the Footscray Bowls Club, which was raising funds for trans and gender diverse people in prison. Yeah, so a really beautiful weekend with community, which has really reminded me what is possible and how important it is to be in community. I think so many of my conversations with activists and people I know who are like politically minded are sort of bogged down lately, and so I encourage everyone to just, first of all, step outside and also just spend time with other people in the struggle and really remember that we actually can get things done beyond all of the distractions. And yeah, it's also wonderful to just spend time with community, right? Anyway, with that, we will get on to our headlines in just a moment. Stay tuned.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Every form of discrimination that exists in our community is magnified and utilised by prisons to cause greater division and disarm solidarity.
We've got to really put a lens of perspective on this and know that there are children being incarcerated as young as 10 years old.
Police and prisons, they're doing exactly what this colony wants them to.
Who do we defend?
Police!
And who else? Prisons, pull them down.
Yay.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down
to the real nitty gritty.
Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, who?
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM and on the dial. It is just about 9 minutes past seven in the morning. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 24th of August. Archive Genocide has broken past 200 million web requests in its second month, keeping record of Israel's war crimes in Gaza and the West Bank on the internet to continue work countless Palestinian journalists have lost their lives for. Archive Genocide is built by a group of researchers dedicated to archiving footage of Israel's war crimes in Gaza and the West Bank, with all evidence going to the International Criminal Court, the Hind Rajab Foundation, and South Africa's legal team at the ICJ. The files are stored using torrents all over the world in order to keep them centralized, meaning the footage cannot be deleted. In 2025, Israel killed at least 84 journalists, as reported by the Committee to Protect Journalists, According to the committee, Israel has killed more journalists than any other government since the organization started collecting records in 1992. And speaking of Hind Rajab, Israeli officials on Wednesday confirmed that they are opening an investigation into the killing of the 5-year-old girl back in 2024. Hind Rajab was in a car with 6 of her family members fleeing Gaza City after Israel issued an evacuation order in January 2024. All 7 people in that car were killed, along with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society medics who were sent to help them in the car. Hind Rajab's grandmother responded to the announcement with this statement, quote, "We, as Hind Rajab's family, do not trust the judiciary of the State of Israel. We hope that justice will be delivered for the entire world. We appeal to the international justice system as a whole." Also in the news this week, we wanted to give a shout out and a congratulations to Sally Goldner, presenter of Out of the Pan, for her award of Outstanding Contribution to Media at the Victorian Pride Awards on Saturday, the 15th of August. Woo! Super amazing to hear that her amazing work is being recognized, and thank you to Sally for all of her amazing work. I know it means a lot to both Hannah and I, and countless people out there, young queers listening. Anyway, you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. Stay tuned.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Do a bit of disrupting and cause a bit of ruckus in the colony.
Always was, always will be.
Not celebrate Australia, but instead pay homage to the resistance of First Nations people against this illegal colonial occupation.
3CR, your station, your voice.
This country's black future is a fire.
Join the Homeless Persons Union Victoria on our new radio show on the mighty 3CR.
Listen in as we embark on a public experiment to grow a homelessness union from the grassroots and on the radio.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a new monthly show on 3CR that seeks to grow a homelessness union in public view and to a wide audience.
We'll speak to people involved in community development, to allies, activists, and anyone who has anything interesting to say about homelessness issues in Melbourne today. Most importantly, we will centre the voices of people who are homeless in Melbourne and beyond.
Featuring interviews, guests, as well as analysis of policy, laws and media discourse that affect the homeless community.
Tune in on 3CR 855am on Tuesday, September the 8th, 12am to 1am for our premier broadcast.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a proud affiliate show of 3CR.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, Hannah's here.
I have arrived.
You have arrived. We're on the radio at 7 in the morning. Sometimes we turn our alarms off instead of pressing snooze.
I know, so bad. And then I was like... just rolled out of bed into my car.
Did you have that feeling? Did you have the feeling where you just wake up? Did you have an alarm for 6:30 or did you just like...
No. Yeah. I just opened my eyes at 6:31 and I was like... and I was in Footscray, so it's a half an hour drive. So I was like... so stressful.
When you have that feeling, you're like, you wake up and you're like, oh...
Yeah, it's like this snooze has been longer than it usually is.
I'm just going to close my eyes for 1 minute and then it's like 45 minutes has gone past and you're like...
Yeah, and you're getting suspicious of the snooze amount. Yeah, that's what happened. Oh, yep. And then I was like, oh, well, I'm already late. Should I make a coffee? And then I was like, no, just go.
You could have brought me a coffee. If at least you're going to be late, you could have brought me a coffee. Honestly.
Oh, you're right. I should have been more late with a coffee. That's way better.
That's all right. How's your weekend anyway?
It's good. I feel like it was really busy.
Yeah.
I can't remember why. Oh, yeah. I worked. But.
Boo.
It's like I'm getting better at my job, which is cool.
Nice.
Crazy. Anyway. But I watched. Oh, what's that movie? The new lesbian movie with Gillian Anderson. Teenage Sex at Camp.
No. I really want to see it with Hannah Einbinder.
I want to see it again.
Okay, cool.
I want to see it again.
We love
Hannah
Einbinder.
I feel like it's one of those weird movies that you got to watch twice.
It's weird?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
It's weird. Great. It's great.
I love it. Yeah, it's I really wanted to see it at the Brunswick Picture House.
Oh, yeah.
That's really close to me.
The new one, right? Is that the new cinema on Sydney Road?
I think so.
Yeah. It looks cute.
But then I looked at all of their times on the weekends and they're like all starting at 8:45 on a Saturday night or Friday night. I'm like, I can't do that. I go to bed at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So if they could have the queer weird movies at at 4:30, and then I can have enough time to make dinner and have a shower and go to bed at 9 o'clock, that'd be great. That's my request to the people who own cinemas.
4 p.m. movies only.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I think I did watch it quite late, actually. Yeah,
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I love Hannah Einbinder so much.
She's amazing. How is she getting the opportunity to live my dream time and time again?
What? Which is what?
Gillian Anderson.
Let's just make a movie with Gillian Anderson. That's your dream?
Yeah, a lesbian movie with Gillian Anderson. Like, what a dream. Oh, she made another gay thing with that other person. Oh, what's her name? She's in Hacks.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really bad at this stuff. But anyway, we love Hannah Einbinder.
She's
queer, anti-Zionist, Jewish.
Yeah, amazing.
Person.
Gene Smart. It's Gene Smart. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and Hax is obviously great. Anyway.
Now
we're going to listen to your interview with the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, Joe Samuel King.
Yep.
And yeah, you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I spoke to her about the importance that dingoes have in ecosystems and how they can restore ecosystems and how there's a lot of lack of protections for them and common misconceptions about dingoes and how actually amazing and beneficial they are in ecosystems. So stay tuned.
Great. Let's do it.
Would you want to start by telling me about the Dingo Conservancy and what the organisation is and how you got involved?
Yeah, so my name is Jo Samuel King. I co-founded the Dingo Conservancy a couple of years ago. I did that for four reasons, really. I started to understand that dingoes were Australia's wolf, our apex predator, and absolutely vital for ecosystem health in Australia. That was the first reason. The second was that I'm from around Victoria, and I came to understand that we had dingoes in Southeast Australia. And thirdly, that governments were killing them on the public purse en masse at scale. And then fourthly, no one knew. So I saw this as really important to create a national advocacy organisation to see if we could ensure that dingoes were properly protected and thriving across Australia.
So are dingoes endangered? Like, how do we know how many dingoes there are currently across the continent? Or?
That is a really good question, and we don't, because no one's been counting. Because they've been treated as what are called wild dogs or pests, they're not counted. The only two populations that have been counted are in Victoria. The Victorian government did a census in 2023 as a review of dingo, as part of a review of dingo management. What they found in Victoria, at least, were that there are two populations. In the northwest Victoria, there's a tiny population called the Wilcur or Mallee dingo, and that population is on the brink of extinction. There are less than 100 mature individuals there. They are highly inbred and in real trouble from a genetic perspective. And are unlikely to persist without genetic rescue. In the rest of Victoria, they're locally extinct in central Victoria, and then in eastern Victoria, there's a population of around somewhere between 2,000 to, I think it was a around 2,000 mature individuals, and that population is declining. We, as an organisation, looked at the, what's called the catch per unit effort as a marker of population decline. That's if you set out traps, how many dingoes do you catch? Because in Victoria, government employees are paid to catch and kill dingoes. And what we found is, based on that catch per unit effort data, that the dingo population in eastern Victoria is declining to a point that they could be considered critically endangered. So what we know is, for most of Australia, we don't know. For the two populations that have been counted, they are both eligible to be considered critically endangered, and the one in northwest Victoria on the brink of extinction.
So what is the reason for the government killing dingoes, and what's the public perception of them?
It's a cultural and a political one. I think it goes back to even very early settlement, where we came to this country assuming it would be like England, where the apex predator had been removed, the European wolf. And we expected to just be able to bring our sheep, which are sitting ducks to all kinds of predators. And then when the dingo did what it does, which is predate on sitting ducks, whether they be ducks or sheep or whatever it might be, we were horrified. And it evoked in us a very aggressive response to what was then called the wild dogs, and it's still called wild dogs. And we have come to this country with a very basic mentality, which is, if something bothers us, we kill it. And that's the culture that is out there right across Australia, and that's the culture that the politicians tap into, that people want annoying animals dead. That's really the rationale. Mm. And I think it's also because of that, because of a deeply entrenched hatred towards wild dogs, that's where the votes are. And we've never really properly got our heads around how to live with dingoes and how to farm, how to protect our sheep in ways that don't kill dingoes. They're out there. There are lots of options. Governments could compensate farmers for stock losses. They could call dingoes and not wild dogs. Livestock guardian dogs are incredibly effective. Absolutely, they've been proven to work and to be cost effective. Fences can work, lights, all kinds of other non-lethal methods are out there, but you've got to want to.
And how do you think that we can change the public's perception of dingoes and the responses of them?
I think the first thing is to stop calling them wild dogs. We really need to get the message out there that the animals that are currently being called wild dogs are dingoes. And how do we know that? Because it's pretty easy to analyse the DNA of the animals that are killed under the wild dog program, and it's been done. It's been done by three different groups of scientists. In Victoria, it was led by Dr. Andrew Weeks in New South Wales, Dr. Kylie Cairns in South Australia, it was Ravishankar. All three groups of scientists have analysed that DNA to death and found that the animals killed under the wild dog program are dingoes. That's the simple answer. So we need to call a dingo. Now, sometimes there are groups of what are better called free-roaming domestic dogs, particularly around human settlements, and they can also be a problem for sheep. But we need to throw that word out the window, wild dog, it's gone, it's useless, it's misleading, and call them dingoes and free-roaming domestic dogs. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we need to take the heat out of the whole debate, and the best thing to do is to compensate farmers for stock losses. And then we need to work with government to see dingoes protected right across the country, and then work with farmers to help them, instigate non-lethal methods of livestock protection.
Mm. And I heard that dingoes are the only indigenous animal that are protected in national parks, but it's legal to kill them outside the national park. Is this true?
It's way more confusing than that and changes state by state.
Mm.
I don't think there's any state that is actually properly protecting dingoes throughout national parks. Say, take Victoria. That's probably the best state, Victoria and ACT. They're protected across most public land, but then there's a 3-kilometre buffer zone where they are actively hunted, and that works on the public purse, and that works out to about a third of public land, and is still resulting in dingo population declines to the point that they can be considered critically endangered. In New South Wales, they are being killed on a landscape-wide scale on the public purse right throughout our national parks. In other states, it varies, but as a general rule, dingoes are being killed on a landscape wide scale right through national parks and private land on the public purse.
Mm. And can you tell me a bit about the ecological benefits of dingoes being in an environment, and what the different have you seen the differences in areas where there are dingo populations compared to areas where there aren't, and what that looks like for the environment?
That is a great question, and probably the key reason why we set up the Dingo Conservancy. Dingoes being in the environment is the difference between a healthy, balanced ecosystem and one that is degraded and simplified and, dominated by feral pests. So the best example is probably Wooleen Station. It's a very, very large cattle station in Western Australia. And dingoes were eradicated in the early 20th century as part of the grazing operations there. Over the following decades, the land became more and more degraded by a combination of grazing, but also feral pests, particularly goats, and overabundant kangaroos, to the point that the land was no longer profitable. And then back in 2007, an enlightened grazier by the name of David Pollock let dingoes return back onto his property. He had cattle on that property, and what he found was that when he didn't kill the dingoes, they actually left his cattle alone. And what he saw was that goats were eradicated from his property, and the kangaroo numbers dropped by about 90% from around 15,000 to down to the order of 1,500. And in the following couple of decades, what he's seen is his land regenerate, particularly his rivers start to run clean because the goats are no longer denuding the riparian vegetation. He's also seen cat and fox numbers plummet and a wide variety of bird species return. That's probably our best example. It's very much a Australian Yellowstone example, and that's been written up recently in a research paper by Zali, but I'll need to get you her surname. I think it's entitled something like Dingoes Can Eradicate Goats. That's probably our best example. I've also seen in Indigenous protected areas where dingoes are not killed, that there are critically endangered bird species surviving where they survive nowhere else. I think the best is an area just on the border of Western Australia and Northern Territory where the night parrot was thought to be extinct but has been rediscovered in an area where there are dingoes. And what they've found is that where there are night parrots, there are dingoes and there aren't cats. But where there are not dingoes, there are cats and no night parrots. I think there was a similar example in New South Wales with the Manning River turtle, that where there are dingoes, the Manning River turtle persists and fox numbers are much lower, and the opposite is also correct.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
What's that up there on the airwaves? Is it 3AK? Is it the ABC? No, it's 3CR. Faster than Schildberger. More relevant than Mike Willacy. Able to get more writs than Darren Hinch. Yes, 3CR. With music and interviews totally off the planet. With powers and abilities far greater than commercial radio. And who, disguised as a mild-mannered community radio station, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the non-commercial way.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That was This World Couldn't See Us by Nabiha Iqbal. We're going to be continuing to listen to the interview that I did with Joe Samuel King, the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy. Stay tuned.
Where there aren't any dingoes, are there any talks on reintroducing dingoes to areas where they naturally should be? Or are we just not there yet with the government's laws and things like that?
There was a recommendation in the inquiry into ecosystem decline that dingoes be restored to the Grampians National Park, but that was shot down by the relevant local politicians because of farming interests. I'd have to say we're certainly not there yet.
Mm.
I could imagine Wilson's Promontory would be a good place for dingoes to be, introduced or brought back into their natural range. Because I think there's moves to fence off Wilson's Promontory, but I haven't heard of that as even being on the table. I think we're not there yet.
Mm.
I don't think the first thing we've got to stop doing is stop killing them. And then we've really got to support the farmers to move across to a whole cultural shift. They've got to understand the benefits of dingoes to the landscape and to their farming practices, and they need to be supported into that. Then we might be able to allow dingoes to come back into their natural range.
Mm. And how do you think that we can change the culture of farmer versus dingo? And have you spoken to farmers with this organisation and like seen a change in perspective?
It's a great question. Yes, we have. There's Landholders for Dingoes, which is a whole organisation set up to represent landholders, particularly farmers who are really keen and understand the benefits of dingoes to the landscape. So they're certainly out there. There's a farmer in Mount Beauty in Victoria that welcomes dingoes onto his property. He has cattle, goats and chickens, and he doesn't kill the dingoes around his property, and what he finds is he has no stock losses. It's a really important management technique, the pull back, don't kill. What's really important about that is then dingo pack structures are maintained, because if you've got dingoes on your property that aren't killing livestock, they're actually defending the territory from other predators, whether it's other dingoes or foxes or wild pigs that might kill livestock on your property. His dingoes around his property don't kill livestock. He doesn't kill them. We're good. Mm. And it's really interesting that even his goats and chickens are okay. We're not exactly sure why, but it could be because the cattle are on the outside of the property and the goats and chickens are on the middle. And then the dingoes he's got leave them all alone. Also, he's found that he's got less deer on his property than his neighbours do, he thinks, because the dingoes may be keeping the deer population numbers down. So he's great. We're in Victoria and he's certainly a great asset. There's another cattle property in East Gippsland where the young farmers just take videos of the dingoes on their property. Again, they have no stock losses, no problems. There are sheep farmers who are using livestock guardian dogs and finding them incredibly effective. Wayne Waite is one up in Queensland. He is very pro-dingo and pro-non-lethal coexistence measures. It's a matter of really getting the word out and working in dialogue. And I think that with those two things, call them dingoes, not wild dogs, get the government to actually compensate for stock losses, takes the heat out of the argument, and then we can protect the dingoes and move to non-lethal measures.
Yeah, I wanted to also maybe talk more about, because pest species like foxes kill small marsupials and small mammals. I was going to ask if dingoes do that as well, or if, because you said that...
That's another really good question. I love it. Yeah. Dingoes predate on what is most abundant.
Mm.
And the great thing about that is they leave the endangered ones alone because there aren't many of them. It's almost built into the way that they work, which is fabulous. So some traditional owner rangers have been doing scat analysis of dingoes across the country. And what they find time and time again is that dingoes take what's abundant. So, you know, if it's up in the Imagine National Park, it's kangaroos. If it's in other places, it might be swamp wallabies. But it's not the little endangered ones.
Wow. So they just naturally restore the ecosystem to make it even. Wow. That's amazing.
Yep. Natural pest managers.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that listeners can do to help protect dingoes or help spread the word? Or is there any way that people can get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. There are stacks of ways, and we want people to be really individual with this. Let me give you some options. Mm-hmm. You can join the organisations that are committed to protecting dingoes. We're an incorporated association, so you're welcome to join our Facebook group, the Dingo Conservancy, and become a paid-up member. You can donate. There's also Defend the Wild is one of our partner organisations, fabulous pro-dingo organisation.
And even subtropical rainforests that don't usually burn were actually on fire.
We have the obligation to care for country.
So much forest burnt that around 3 billion animals are either killed or displaced.
The more we push back against the colonial apparatus, the more positive change we can have in terms of addressing climate change.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical. ReCR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show, and we're just going to finish off that interview that I did with the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, Joe Samuel King. Is there anything that listeners can do to help protect dingoes or help spread the word? Or is there any way that people can get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. There are stacks of ways, and we want people to be really individual with this. Let me give you some options. Mm-hmm. You can join the organisations that are committed to protecting dingoes. We're an incorporated association, so you're welcome to join our Facebook group, the Dingo Conservancy, and become a paid-up member. you can donate. There's also Defend the Wild is one of our partner organisations, fabulous pro-dingo organisation, as is Dingo Culture, which is the Indigenous voice, the traditional owner voice for dingoes. There'd be three of a number of organisations that are really strongly pro-dingo. You can start to talk to your local members. This is a political thing, and politicians need to know that their voters care and will vote. So even just contacting your local member, it's incredibly important. I think from a southeast Australian perspective, there are two really important things that can be done now. In New South Wales, there's an inquiry into dingo management in New South Wales, New South Wales National Parks. That's fabulous, but we're going to need to follow up with members of parliament making decisions to protect dingoes in national parks. So if you're in New South Wales, now's a really good time to start to reach out to your local members and say, we care about dingoes, this is crazy, what are you doing? Protect them in national parks, particularly given that national parks are meant to be there for the conservation of nature.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to three times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial. You were just listening to Hannah's conversation with the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, Jo Samuel King, speaking about the difficulties in protecting dingoes, their lack of protections, and how beneficial dingoes are within ecosystems across the continent. We're now going to listen to an interview from Saturday's episode of Asia Pacific Currents, in which Giselle Hannah spoke with president of Doro Chiba, a union representing railway workers in the privatized Chiba train line in Japan. The president is named Michi Toshi Seki and is translated by international solidarity activist Tadeshi Setu. And they're speaking about their four decades of struggle against privatization and maintaining worker solidarity over decades of state repression. The interview begins with Giselle asking about Doro Chiba itself.
Doro Chiba wa unten shoku no rodou kumiai, Doro no Chiba chihou honbu deshita ga.
Doro Chiba was originally the Chiba regional headquarters of Doro National, a union representing train drivers. Doro Chiba was formed in March 1979 when we split off from Doro and became an independent union. On April 1st, 1987, the Japan National Railways, JNR, split up and privatized into seven separate companies. 200,000 of the 400,000 national railway workers lost their jobs, and 200 workers were driven to suicide. The membership of the largest railway union, Kokuro, saw its membership whittled down from 200,000 to 40,000. Doro National chose a survival strategy that involved going along with both the privatization and the firing of workers.
Doro Tsuba was the only union to fight back by launching strikes. We are still fighting not just to reverse the dismissal of our comrades. It is because this attack is a current impending issue. The privatization of the JNR was the largest post-war attack aimed at dismantling the labor movement, directed not only at the national railway workers, but at all workers. Its aim was turning Japan into a state capable of waging war, and it also marked the starting point of the neoliberal assault in Japan. That is the primary reason we have continued our struggle to this day.
The hearing in the Tokyo High Court is being described as a decisive moment. What is at stake in this case, and why do you believe it could finally expose the truth about the dismissal of the 1,047 railway workers?
当初、国家と JR によって隠されていた真実があります。私たちの組合員は採
用 There is a truth that was initially concealed by the government and JRs, the Japan National, Japan Railway Companies. Our union members has originally been on the list of prospective hires, but were removed from the list at the last minute to eliminate labor unions opposed to the privatization. We brought this truth to light through our struggle. In 2015, we secured the final Supreme Court ruling. Quote, the criteria used by JR to reject these applicants constituted an unfair labor practice. End quote. And we also revealed that JR itself had directed the creation of this criteria. The current legal battle is a fight demanding a retrial of all cases based on the truth that has been brought to light. At the heart of this battle is the examination of two witnesses, the current president of JR East Company and the former president of JR West Company, who had done the work of creating the firing list shortly before the privatization of JNR. The unfairness of the dismissal has already been established in court. However, the courts have consistently ruled that JR bears no responsibility. That is precisely why the testimony of these two witnesses is crucial. At the second hearing on January 23rd, the presiding judge stated clearly, quote, it comes down to whether JR will admit to having committed an unfair labor practice or call witnesses, end quote.
You've argued that the privatization of Japan National Railways wasn't simply an economic reform, but a political project to weaken the trade union movement and pave the way for Japan's remilitarization. Can you explain that connection for our listeners?
これについては当時の首相中曽根が狙いを語っています。国労を潰し、総評社会党を破滅に追い込む。
That then PM 安弘中曽根 explained his intentions. Quote, we have carried out the privatization of JNR with a clear intention of crushing the National Railway Workers Union, Kokuro, and driving Soho and the Socialist Party to ruin, end quote. End quote. Through administrative reform, we will purify the foundation of politics and enact our fine constitution as the supreme norm of the nation, end quote. That means slashing of Article 9. Renunciation of war and war potential. True to these words, Soho, which at the time was the National Trade Union Center, dissolved itself, and the Socialist Party was dismantled.
Doro Chiba has maintained this campaign for almost four decades, despite repeated setbacks in the courts. What has kept your members committed to the fight, and what has this struggle meant for the broader Japanese labor movement?
直接には民営化反対闘争を戦い抜いたことが大きかった。
The decisive factor was the fact that we fought squarely against the privatization of the JNR. We confronted a state-level offensive head-on, staging strikes while putting our jobs on the line. Even though some of us were actually dismissed, we maintained our solidarity and carried our unity into the new JR workplaces. Because of that struggle, whenever we faced various attacks afterwards, we have steadfastly upheld the principle of fighting for the sake of the entire labor movement and the entire working class. Doro Chiba is a union of ordinary workers, and it has shortcomings and imperfections. Yet, at the decisive moment, it has remained true to this core principle. Our conviction in the path Doro Chiba has taken is unshakable. Many workers and labor unions across Japan rose up to support the struggle of the 1,047 JNR workers, forming a broad-based support network. This movement served as a powerful force that prevented the immediate sweeping advance of neoliberal attacks following the privatization of the JNR, and it has played a major role in blocking the constitutional revision to this day. In an effort to bring this struggle to an end, the government made every effort to end the conflict through reconciliation. However, even now, we continue our struggle against the privatization of JNR.
Well, finally, what message would you like to send to workers and trade unionists in Australia? And what does international solidarity mean to Doro Chiba at this point in your campaign?
時代は激動しています。7月8日、トランプは再びイランへの攻撃を再開しました。アメリカが
We are living in turbulent times. On July 8th, Trump resumed attacks on Iran. The United States is violently dismantling the international order it once upheld so long. At the heart of this lies a war of aggression aimed to regime change of China. The United States has embarked on this war of aggression, and Japanese PM Takaichi is charging ahead in complete alignment with Trump. We now stand at the historic crossroads. We will allow this war of aggression against China, a world war, nuclear war, to proceed. That is precisely why we believe we must restore the power of militant labor unions in Japan. To prevent a world war, this is no other way but for workers to stand in solidarity across national borders and rise up to fight. As in previous years, we will hold the National Workers' All Right Rally on November 1st and an International Solidarity Rally on October the 31. We are determined to win the struggle to overturn the dismissal of 1,047 JNR workers and to achieve the revitalization of the Japanese labor movement. We warmly invite our friends in Australia to join us. Thank you so much.
Three CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. That song was called Good Bloke by Rub, who I had the pleasure of seeing yesterday at Footscray Bowls Club raising funds for trans and gender diverse people in prison. And before that you heard a conversation that Giselle Hanna of Asia Pacific Currents had with the president of Japanese Union Doro Chiba, which represents railway workers in the privatized Chiba train line. The president's name is Michi Toshi Seki, and it was translated by international solidarity activist Tadeshi Setu. And they were speaking about the four decades the union has struggled against privatization and maintaining solidarity over that time. And now we're joined on the line by Tom Locke, a rank-and-file AEU member, as well as a member of Fight the Crisis, a group organising within the union, and we'll be speaking about the deal accepted by the Australian Education Union last week, which will mean now that teachers across Circle Victoria will become the highest paid in the continent, a victory that comes after months of negotiations, strikes, and two previous offers which were rejected by members. Good morning, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Rob. You're welcome. It's good to be on 3CR.
Tom, why don't you start by telling us about the deal?
Okay, so last Monday, a majority of AU members voted in favour of accepting the government's fourth offer. So a total of four offers had been made. One was made on the eve of the first strike in March, in which the AU leadership took it to State Council, recommended they reject it, and they did reject it. Then a second improved offer was made in May, in which the AU leadership took it to State Council and endorsed it, and State Council voted with a majority to support it. And then members voted to reject it, 58%. A third offer was then made, and 52% of members voted to reject it. And then now finally the fourth offer was made in August and 79% of members voted to accept it. So that's just a very brief overview of how the government's position developed over the course of the last 6 or so months.
Mm. So how does this deal differ from the other offers?
So we saw a substantial improvement between March and May. Long story short, the offer that was made in March was essentially 17% over 4 years. We had asked for 35% over 3 years. And without getting into the nitty-gritty of the March offer, it was essentially a 17% pay rise over 4 years with more work, whereas we were asking for substantial workload reductions in the form of a hard cap of class sizes. So currently there's no cap on class sizes. Schools aim to plan for classes of no more than 25, but I'm aware of classes being as large as 30 students. And at my school out in the western suburbs, we have many classes that are 26, 27 students. There was no reduction in face-to-face teaching. So currently we teach a maximum of 18 and a half hours of classes per week, assuming that you work 5 days a week. And there was no reduction in that either. So... In terms of the offer that was made in May, it was a substantial improvement in terms of pay. Teachers were offered roughly 28% over 4 years compared to the 17%. But one of the real sticking points, on top of there being no reduction in class or hard cap on class sizes nor face-to-face teaching, was that ES, so education support, essentially everyone else that worked at the school other than teachers and principals were offered substantially less than what teachers and principals were offered in terms of pay rises. It worked out to be about 22% compared to our 28 to 32%, depending on what level or what on your experience. And about a third of that pay rise came in the form of a lump sum allowance, which many members saw as, frankly, insulting, because not only were our colleagues that do very important work, the colleagues that sit with students or assist students with additional needs, complete the admin work, look after our facilities, not only were they offered substantially less than our, what I would honestly see as a subpar pay rise anyway, but they were offered about a third of that pay rise in the form of an allowance. So I think that whilst I can only offer my own perspective and there's no hard data on why members rejected it, I see that as a major driving force as to why the May offer was rejected by almost 58% of members.
What role did rank and file activism play in, rejecting the first three offers and accepting the fourth one?
It's a great question, Rob. When I was first asked to come on, I've been spending the weekend thinking about just the campaign in general, and I thought a good opportunity to tell the story, obviously just from my perspective, but I really think the story of the 2026 campaign should be one of us as rank and file members raising our own expectations, exceeding them, and then raising them again. So if we go back to the March strike, because we live in Australia and we have to jump through the various hoops that is Australian industrial relations law, we have to actually vote in favour of taking industrial action first. And Over about 95% of members voted in favour of striking back in March. And fortunately, our AU leaders called a strike almost immediately after the announcement of those results. And I remember the mood on the day of, I think it was March 24, when over 35,000 teachers and school staff took to the streets of Melbourne and regional centres demanding the state government address the crisis in our public schools. It was one of celebration. I think there was just so much anxiety after the previous offer that delivered 2% pay rises over 2% annual pay rises over the course of 4 years, so 8% total. That came out of an industrial campaign that didn't involve one single strike. There was just this mood of relief and celebration that we were actually on the streets, showing how powerful our union can be and having our voices heard. And so immediately after that campaign, our leaders called for rolling half-day stoppages. It was 4 or 5 weeks of localised half-day stop work actions that were initially targeted at Labor MPs' offices and then would expand across the state. And whilst there was definitely an argument that we should have called for another full-day strike, I personally would have liked to have seen those rolling stoppages culminate in a full-day strike, or maybe even be sandwiched by a full-day strike at the start of term two and followed by the rolling stoppages and then third full-day strike. At that moment, there seemed to be a coherent plan. We seemed to be all united. It was only when, on the Monday before the first rolling stoppages were to occur in week three of term two, if I'm not mistaken, that we all received an email saying that the government had offered to move on a variety of positions. And in order for them to move on those positions, we had to pause our industrial action. And at that moment, things began to fracture. There was concern about what the government was going to move on, to what extent they were going to move on these ambiguous positions. And I remember privately thinking, okay, this is concerning, but trying to remain optimistic and, well, frankly, united until we actually received further information. And what ensued was 2 weeks of briefings, and we received little information on what the government was actually going to move on. And then came mid-May, the second offer that went from about 17% pay rise over 4 years to 28 to 32% over 4 years, but with the lower pay increases for ES staff that also came in the form of an allowance, partly in the form of allowance. That's when things began to fracture, and the bottom-up grassroots organising from organisations like Fight the Crisis, Socialists in Schools, as well as just people or members in their sub-branches and regions started to really activate and show that there was a plurality of opinions on how things should proceed, both strategically but also in terms of what we could actually achieve.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting to hear how Fight the Crisis and, I guess, the rank and file of the AU in general has been able to maintain the tension against the government to get this across the line. I also wanted to ask you, Tom, obviously up until a few weeks ago, Ben Carroll was the education minister. Do you think his rise to premiership changed the government's approach to the offer and the AU's industrial action?
It's interesting you ask that question. I'm forever trying to be optimistic. I think it's important to be optimistic. However, probably a more accurate way of putting it is reserved optimism. Soon after Ben Carroll replaced Jacinta Allen, there was an a couple of articles, I think it was the Guardian and the Herald Sun, saying that Ben Carroll, it was Jacinta Allen that was blocking full school funding. So just for some context, Victorian schools are the only schools that are not fully funded as per the school resource standard. So that is a standard that, a package that determines what a school requires in order to be fully funded. So to put it simply, Victorian schools are roughly underfunded by about 10%. And so the federal and state governments have a deal in which the state government will provide 75% of funding. The federal government will then provide 25% of funding. As it stands, the Victorian government provides 70%, and so the federal government only provides 20%, which means there's a 10% gap. When I saw that article, I thought, well, maybe this is just trying to create a positive narrative around Ben Carroll. And so far, all we've received is a commitment to make a commitment. Shortly before this fourth offer was made, the state government announced full funding, and our union celebrated that. And there was definitely some communications positioning that as part of a win of the campaign. However, to date, we have not received any details on when that full funding will commence, whether it will commence, say, at the start of next year, which is what I personally would like to see. And I suspect many AAU members, if not the vast majority, would like to see that. Or it may start further into the future. On top of that, we haven't received any details about what that funding will look like. Part of our demands, particularly in the log of claims that we compiled last year, was that on top of a 35% pay increase over 3 years, a cap, a hard cap on class sizes, a reduction to face-to-face teaching, improved recognition of education support qualifications, was full funding to actually fund the improvements that we and our students not only need but deserve, because at the end of the day, we can't actually facilitate an improved agreement without money. And so I am very hesitant to give Ben Carroll much credit for this fourth offer. I think it was honestly inevitable, because they the election's on a knife edge, and they needed to wrap this up. The last thing the state government needed, particularly the state Labor government, wants going into a very close election, an election in which they're frankly behind, is a dispute with public school teachers and staff.
I'll just remind listeners that you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR. We're currently on the line with Thomas Locke, a rank-and-file AAU member, as well as a member of Fight the Crisis, a group organising within the AAU. And we're speaking about the deal that the Australian Education Union accepted last week, making teachers across so-called Victoria the highest paid in the continent, after almost a year of negotiations, strikes, and three previous offers, which were rejected by members. Now, Tom, I also want to speak about, in a similar vein to Lark's question, I want to speak about what you think this sort of win means in the current political climate of the Australian Labor Party actively fighting against disciplined and militant unions such as the CFMU and RAFRU most recently.
It's an interesting question. So I can only speak from my perspective. Whilst the overwhelming majority of members did vote in favour of this deal, I am hesitant to describe it as a win in terms of paying conditions. My personal position is the pay increase is satisfactory. It has meant that we've caught up with the wages that we lost in the last agreement. My understanding is that our purchasing power went backwards by about 11%. between 2022 and 2026, and this offer catches up to that. So that is a win. However, in lieu of a hard cap on class sizes, a reduction of face-to-face teaching, and no solid, detailed commitment to fully fund our schools from start of next year, I'm hesitant to describe the actual, whilst there are definitely wins in this agreement, I'm hesitant to describe this whole agreement as definitively a win. In saying that, and this is a good segue to your question around CFMEU and RAFU, there are a lot of wins in terms of the industrial campaign. I very much see the last 6 or so months as rank and file members raising expectations, exceeding them, and then raising them again. We raised expectations when we voted overwhelmingly to strike in March. We raised expectations again when over 35,000 members took to the streets in March and demanded that the state government fix the crisis in our public schools. We then exceeded expectations when we voted against an offer that members saw as subpar and that also divided teachers and education support staff. We then raised expectations again and exceeded them when we rejected another offer that failed to fix the crisis in our public schools. Just that alone showed that not only were members willing to go against a union-endorsed offer, but proved that you could quickly extract an improved offer after going against the tide. Sure, that July offer still fell short. That's why 52% of members, or I suspect 52% of members, voted against it. But it still provided definitive evidence that built on what the nurses did back in 2024 when they rejected their own union-endorsed offer and extracted a significantly improved offer afterwards. It provides a lot of inspiration to rank-and-file members. I hope it provides a lot of inspiration to rank-and-file members across Australia that you can ask for more and you can get more. And so, as I said, I really hope that our 2026 campaign is seen as one of raising expectations, exceeding them and raising them again.
I just have one more last question before I let you go, Tom. And it's just a little bit about Fight the Crisis. What is, so obviously Fight the Crisis has had a very active role in organizing during this time. What is, like, have y'all as an organization thought about sort of what's next?
So there's been robust discussion throughout the campaign. I actually only became a member of Fight the Crisis about 2 months ago. And I've been very impressed by the pluralism and debate within the organization, because as a union that represents tens of thousands of workers across the state, any organisation that is working within our union that is seeking to build rank-and-file capacity, build rank-and-file democracy and representation, I think needs to replicate those processes within their own organisation. We are meeting this week to reflect on the campaign and then decide on how we are going to move forward, what our strategy is going to be, what our processes are going to be, and really try and draw strength from the 2026 campaign. But then I also just really want to encourage any AAU member or school staff that is listening today to get involved in our union as a whole. When I started teaching 4 years ago, my school didn't have a sub-branch, and I remember about halfway through the year, once I started to get relatively settled, although it takes more than 6 months to settle into the teaching profession, to say the least.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program.
Sorry, Tom, go ahead. I accidentally clicked there.
No, that's all right. It's a Monday morning. These things happen. I would just really encourage members to get involved. If your school doesn't have a sub-branch, call your organiser and ask them, how can I set up a sub-branch? I've had a lot of help from, notwithstanding my concerns about how things have been run, I've had an immense amount of help from my regional organiser as well as others that work for the union in building our sub-branch. We went from 70 members in 2023 to about 140 this year. Even if you, if anyone wants to search me up on the universal contact list on Outlook, my name's Thomas Locke. I'm the only one, Thomas Locke on the Outlook group, so you should be able to find me. But yeah, I just encourage everyone that is a member to become active within our union, whether that's at a sub-branch level, whether that's going to regional meetings, whether that's going to a long-term planning document, professional development training session, which is what I'm about to do in today, because there are a lot of wins in this agreement. We've been able to reduce meetings from 80 hours a year to 40 hours a year, and whilst the way that it's written in the agreement is not ironclad, that is an opportunity to build capacity at a local level, at a school level, and ensure that the agreement is implemented in the way that our union intends it to be implemented. So yeah, get involved.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tom, and good luck in
thank you in
fighting for more rank and file activism.
I appreciate it, Rob. Thanks, mate.
That was Thomas Locke, a rank and file member of the Australian Education Union, speaking about the deal that the union accepted last Monday, bringing teachers in so-called Victoria to become the highest paid in the continent, which is obviously a victory that an acceptance of an offer that comes after months of negotiations, strikes, and three previous offers. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
CR, always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8:55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. It is 28 minutes past 8 on a Monday morning, which is pretty much means that the show is coming to an end. We'll just remind listeners what you heard on the show before we get out of here and Women on the Line begins. So first up on the show, we had a two-part interview that Hannah did with the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, Joe Samuel King, talking about the difficulties of protecting dingoes, their lack of protections, and how beneficial they are to ecosystems across the continent. We also heard an interview that Asia Pacific Currents, Giselle Hannah, did with the president of Dorochiba, a Japanese railway workers' union, fighting against the privatization of the train line in Chiba, Japan. Speaking about their struggle over four decades and maintaining worker solidarity. And the show ended with a conversation with Tom Locke, a rank and file AEU member and also a member of Fight the Crisis, a group organizing within the AEU, and speaking about the offer that they accepted in August after months of negotiations and three previous offers. And with that, we will see you next week. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.